Hello, and welcome to State of Our Workforce. My name is Michelle Wilson, and I am the Director of Evaluation and Learning at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. Each month on State of Our Workforce, we take a journey into the heart of workforce innovation and explore how to build an equitable workforce. In this episode, we're diving into a crisis that affects nearly every working family in America, childcare. But this isn't just a story about rising costs or long wait lists. It's a story about job quality. Nearly half of all working parents say they've had to reduce hours or leave the workforce altogether because of unstable, unaffordable child care. And at the same time, the people we depend on to care for our kids, child care educators, most of them women and people of color, are working under some of the most challenging conditions in our economy. Low wages, limited benefits, and too little support. So what's really at stake? And what would it look like to build a childcare system that works for both families and educators? That's what we're talking about today. I'm joined by three incredible guests who live and lead in this space every day. Amy O'Leary, Executive Director of Strategies for Children, Gloria Valentine, a family childcare educator, and Stephanie LaPierre, a childcare educator at Boston University's Children's Center. Together, we'll explore what job quality means in childcare, why it matters for equity, and what needs to change if we're serious about valuing care as essential infrastructure. One of the things that I like to do, I'm a collector of storytellers. I love telling stories and I love collecting stories. So I want to just get us going and like jump right in. And I want to hear what brought you into this work? Like, what's your why? And so who wants that? So I'm going to ping to you, Gloria, and let you start by telling us your stories and just say a little bit more about who you are.
Okay. Yes. I am a family childcare educator. I've been in the field for now 26 years, taking care of children of mixed ages at the beginning of my career, then later on transitioning into more of a preschool setting in my program. And I'm in the city of Boston. What brought me into this field was I had two young children at that time, and I wanted to be home with them. And I found out about family childcare through a program that I had been working in. And it seemed like such a perfect opportunity to be with my two eldest daughters at that time. And in a way to have some finances, but still have the sort of the luxury of being home with them and be their, you know, continue to be their first teachers, while also including other children in the space.
For sure. So I appreciate what you're saying. It's so true. We did some work and interview with different care providers, but providers nonetheless in the Boston area. And one of the things that you hear so often is that a lot of times people become providers because of the personal connection that they have for it and wanting to give the same level of care to who they are serving or working with that they want for their own family. So that's fantastic. That's a beautiful story. So we're going to turn to Stephanie. Your story is next. Stephanie LaPierre, tell us, like, I know unions are a big part of your work, but share with us a little bit about who you are, how you showed up in this space, and why it all matters to you.
Yeah. So I've always had a passion for small minds. When you talk to a child and they share things with you and you just get to see how their small mind evolves from one conversation or an experience that they had, I wanted to know I wanted to know what's inside that mind and study early childhood development. So I was a student at Bunker Hill Community College. They have an amazing early education program. I feel like I had some of the strongest, best professors at that program. And that fostered my passion for working with young children and that exploration of their young minds. I was asked by one of my professors if I wanted to volunteer at Head Start. And I had heard of Head Start before because that's where my sisters went to when they were younger. And I just remember one of their teachers that was so warm and so welcoming. And she looked like me. She looked like my family. And so that was the first time I ever saw a teacher that looked like me. And so I always kept her in my heart and Head Start in my heart as well. And so working at Head Start was a great opportunity because it started as I started as a volunteer and then I ended up being an assistant teacher there. And over time, I have dabbled in a little bit in psychology, and that's where I am finishing my undergrad degree at Boston University.
Nice.
Psychology major. But I'm also working at their children's center. So they have a children's center that caters to families that work for the university, as in faculty, staff, and undergraduate students. I realized that we had a very specific type of family at the university, at the Children's Center, and that was a very privileged family. Their parents might be a professor, or they might lead a lab at Boston University. And that was the type of families that we were getting here, the majority of the families that we were getting here. I was seeing a lack of graduate students, and I was not seeing anybody that worked in the staff, as in working in a dining hall or working for maintenance. And that was very confusing to me. And then you see the cost of tuition and it starts to make sense. Mm-hmm. Oh, they can't afford to bring their child in here. They're eligible, and it's a benefit, but they can't afford it. And my work is rooted in making sure that our children's center is a place that's welcoming and that we're not just offering eligibility. We are actually helping these families by,
No, fine. What I hear you saying is like to access, you are concerned access, about access, and you want to make it readily available. And so you're committed to the space of creating equitable and accessible places. It's not just enough to show up, but it's giving them the same sort of experience people of privilege have in doing this.
Exactly.
We'll all be able to do that. I think that's fantastic. So I'm curious. So now we're going to go to Amy. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Great to be here.
I'm excited to have you. I'm excited about this conversation just because of the work that we've been doing in a child's care space. So I'm going to let you go ahead and hop in and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your why and give us a story.
Thanks so much, Michelle. And it's great to be here with Stephanie and Gloria. I had a BA in psychology and a minor in early childhood in undergrad and moved to Boston and wanted to work with young children and families. Got a job as a preschool teacher at Ellis Early Learning, which is in the south end of Boston. And there were infants, toddlers, preschoolers. We had kindergarten at the time because the school district only had half the kindergartners there, an after-school program, and an adult day health program. And it really was this kind of pillar of the community. I learned so much as an educator. And then, you know, in the back of my mind, I thought, how hard could it be to be a director? And then, like many good teachers, I was elevated to be a director. I was young. I had, you know, 3 years of teaching under my belt. And that, when I became a director, is where I really thought about advocacy and policy, because suddenly I had to do the enrollment. We had all different kinds of funding streams supporting children at Ellis, and also the kind of the transition to kindergarten. We were such a resource in the community, but it didn't feel that way when the kids were going on to the next stage of learning. So I spent 10 years in Boston at Ellis. And at the time, Boston had this infrastructure that helped us learn about advocacy and policy. both kind of learning through experience, but then thinking about what it meant for children and families. When I graduated from college, I interviewed with Margaret Blood, who was an alum of Skidmore, where I had gone to undergrad. And I did an informational interview with her when I graduated. And 10 years after that interview, she hired me at Strategies for Children.
Oh, wow.
And so Strategies for Children is an advocacy policy organization. And we originally started when there was a big pre-K movement across the country. And what would it look like if we had public funds that went to early, you know, to preschool age children? And so my work at Strategies over the last 22 years has been about kind of thinking about the policy and advocacy angle as an early educator. I also got my master's degree and started teaching in higher ed. So I teach at Boston University, at Cambridge College, at University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, and I'm teaching a lot of courses around advocacy and policy and leadership. And it is so inspiring to see early educators kind of start, with their CDA, their AA, their BA, and continue on. And I believe that advocacy and policy are just as critical as curriculum development and family engagement and, you know, health and safety when we think about young children.
Yeah.
So I feel lucky to be in an organization now, now as the executive director, where we can really help guide that work. Our motto has been connecting people to people, people to policy, and people to power.
That is fantastic. There are a couple of things. As I said, we've been doing some work in the child care space at the National Fund for a while. And some of the things that I think that people aren't aware of, like the need for advocacy, number one. The issues around job quality, which is what I want us to hop into,
right.
too. But the other part of this is just part of the advocacy and the job quality. And you all have been on the forefront of this. A lot of is about how we talk about this space, how we name the people in the space, how we refer to them in the space. And this is something I think, for instance, we talk about childcare educators. We talk about providers. And can you just speak briefly about why that is so important to the narrative around the work happening in this field. Anybody can hop in on that.
What was the question? I'm sorry.
The question is, so one of the part of the, from what I see, part of the narrative change is around how we talk about the work. And so we identify folks as early child care educators or and providers, and we're very particular about that language for a reason. And so in my mind, it is directly connected to how we elevate the field and how we elevate everyone in the field. And I just I don't know if you have any additional comments, like, yeah, that's true, no, that's not true, or that, and this is why it's important.
For many of us, well, I say, let me go back. For myself, mm-hmm. to be considered an early childhood educator is such an important title because it represents, the love that I have for the work that I do that drives me every day with these young babies and the community and the families. But it's a proud, it's a title that I'm very proud to carry. And I think most of us who are in this field are heart-led. Because it is a heart-leading work.
Like, how could it not be, right? Like, how could right. you?
And it matters, and it fuels us to show up every day for our children. And for myself, that's sort of, you know, how I sort of go through my day. It's like, I'm important to somebody, and someone's important to me. So I show up every day with that energy and sort of, like, that spirit of, like, this is such an important job, and I love my job.
Oh yeah.
And I'm proud to call myself an early educator every day.
Well, because it's so critical to the work, right? Like, it's foundational. And so, like, it's an awesome responsibility to have making sure we honor that and how we talk about it and how we lift up and how we tell those stories, is critical to the work. Amy, I'm curious. So let's talk a little bit about the job quality. And I mean, there's the obvious duh factor around why job quality matters in childcare. But I also, but let's take, let's go a layer deeper around how that shows up.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's really important, like the how it shows up, what it looks like, how we talk about it. I mean, my life's work is that we don't use the word daycare anymore. So much of the way, you know, or even when people are like, I like kids, so I can do this, or everybody can do it because everybody was a kid before, you know, a 3-year-old. I think the passion that you see from Gloria and Stephanie as people who are still doing this work, it matters. And when we were thinking about it from a policy perspective, when we created a new part of government called our Department of Early Education and Care, because we knew we needed a place that was consolidated and elevated so that we had our own state agency. And we debated many hours about what words we should use for the department, but it is sending a signal that this is education, that teaching young children can sometimes be more challenging. It's certainly different than teaching a fourth grader or an eighth grader. And I think what we've seen in Massachusetts is, you know, 92% of our workforce is women, 41% of those women are women of color, and when you are people of color. And so when you think about we talk a lot about this in the frame of scarcity to abundance. We have been kind of socialized that, like, do with what you've got, or do less, do more with less money. Or, you know, when I visited a toddler classroom yesterday, and you forget what that feels like to be an adult with 9 people looking up at you, like, you know, it comes flooding back. So, and sometimes we dismiss it as like, oh, that's nice, or some people can have it, or that's great if, you know, some people can have childcare. We know how important it is for not just the children, but for the families. And it matters how we've also talked about the language we use around higher education. We've seen two tracks, like the childcare track and the early education track, the certification track, the non-certification. I think in Massachusetts, we are looking to smooth out some of those terms and acknowledge and appreciate the lived experience where so many women in our field didn't have the opportunity to maybe have a typical college experience. They are willing, able, and like excited to go back. They can't go back from 2 to 3:30 on a Tuesday afternoon. So for me, kind of sitting where I sit, I've been so encouraged to seeing higher ed respond, to see classes in community, and for the people to own the name, like, what are we calling ourselves?
It is hugely important. So I have a funny story because we were doing a site visits around toddlers and classrooms, and we were in Chicago. And we were waiting for someone to be interviewed, and I did all the, I scrubbed my hands, I sat in the classroom, I saw the kid, and I consider myself an ex like auntie arms. I have lots of nieces and nephews. Like, I can do this, right? So I'm sitting there, I'm holding one baby, and it's goo goo gaga. The kid loves me. Another one starts crawling over. I was like, I can do two. I can do two. And then all of a sudden, these babies started popping up from their naps and their cribs like the walking dead. And I was like, what is happening? All these babies. And the educator there, that she was just as calm, just collected, and just responding to it like in like a very nurturing way, like, this is what it is. And it's to your point, not everybody can do it. Just because you've got auntie arms and they've seen a lot of babies does not, it was like not built for this, right? And so I just, that to me, just like to your point, like, it comes flooding back. But if you, but there's critical skills involved in this work.
Absolutely.
Anyways, so that's the thing around job quality. So I'm curious for you, Stephanie, what of job quality, where do you think people misunderstand about job quality and childcare workers? Beyond the fact that, like, oh, anybody can sit with a kid because it's not bad, but what else are we not getting?
I think that in my 5 years of working as an educator, I've witnessed a disconnect between the value of work and the conditions. And by conditions, I mean lack of benefits, unlivable wages, large children and teacher ratios, and minimal support for planning or documentation. And that made me realize that not only do I feel like I failed as a teacher by not being able to have that prep time to be able to make documentation and be able to do these assessments and see where the children are and where I can support them and how I can create a curriculum for them, I feel like not only have I been failed, but I've failed the children too, you know, and it can be so easy to feel that way. And it's because we're not given the tools to do these things intentionally, to be able to provide that high quality care. And so through my role in our union, I'm part of the SEIU 888, Boston University Children's Center Teachers Union. It's a long one, BUCC. Yeah. And I advocate for our educators and represent them. I feel like when we have a strong collective message, that's the best way for them to listen to us. That's how they hear our voices. And in there, you'll find some people that want to use their voice, but they don't know how, and they're maybe not strong enough to use it. But as a union officer, it's important to be that vessel for those teachers, and to be able to give them that quality of job security, you know, that job security and quality, to be able to foster these moments,
sure,
that are more intentional with the children.
Right. So you bring up a really great point about your role as a union rep, because what you're talking about is representation, right? And so, mm-hmm. Amy, you mentioned this too about the percentage of like who shows up in the space, who's working in the space, women of color, right? Like why representation matters and so much. But Stephanie, I think you were talking earlier in your intro about being in a classroom and seeing, you know, teachers who look like you, mm-hmm. And why that matters. What's the difference for women of color, or for people of color, or people who are underrepresented? So it's not just people who are underrepresented in the space. How does it show up differently? What by not paying attention to, or by not being mindful of representation in all areas, why is that? I mean, I know it's going to sound like a crazy question when I say, why is that problematic? Because I think we all know why it's problematic, but I want us to say more. I want us to dig into that around. Let's unpack that a little bit. Let's unpack it.
Yeah, I think educators that would be considered BIPOC, mm-hmm. I think that they bring so much cultural wisdom to the classroom, right? People mm-hmm. want them in the people want them in their classroom to speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. They want them to put this Spanish music and teach mm-hmm. the children mm-hmm. about your culture. But then when it comes to how can I use you as a resource, or can I use you to make leadership decisions, we feel shut out. I definitely felt shut out in those moments. And I think to myself, wow, it would be great to make a decision, not just for me, like for people above us, to not just make decisions for me, but with me.
Right. What I hear you saying, what's really important about this, and I mean, we've seen it so many times. What you're talking about is being in the space where you're being extracted, like there's extraction. Take and then not pour back into or create space for your voice to be heard. And that is hugely problematic. And really, when you think about how that shows, not only does it impact the educator, it impacts the children, it impacts the organization, it impacts the family. Like there's a whole ripple effect to these inequitable practices. And that's what I hear you saying.
Yeah, the best way for us to support that is by giving these teachers a platform, right? And ways for us to give teachers that platform is through fair wages, equitable access to grants and licensures. I think those are places where we can start right now.
I love the way that you phrase that. Giving voice, giving providing a platform, but the plat, because I was thinking, I was like, how is she identifying platform? So I want you to say that again, because I think that's important. So when you talk about providing a platform, talk about again what that means, because that's really important.
The best way for us to be able to support these teachers, to support BIPOC teachers, is to be able to give them a platform. And giving them a platform means being able to give them the space, the community, in the community to be able to make leadership decisions, to be able to have fair wages, be able to have an equitable access to grants and licensures. I think it's like I mentioned earlier, it's very important for these policies to not just be made for us, to support us, but to be made with us. You know, we don't just want to be given a platform. We want to be able to create that platform to then be able to support the other teachers.
And so I'm curious, Gloria, in your years of experience and just the way you show up as a subject matter expert in the space, when you think about voice. Obviously, you're in a position where you have a voice, but what does it look like to be in your position as a subject matter expert on the speaker circuit, engaging folks in this conversation, being the model, like being a model, right? That which is very powerful. One, what does it feel like? And two, how do you use your platform to expand the work in childcare?
Yes. So I have found it really important to always find a place at the table, and how my voice is extremely important, and how what I do is so valuable to the families that I serve, but also like the community with other educators, because I work with other family childcare educators and have a connection with them. I'm able to share what I've learned from I am currently a president of the GBEAN board. We are a nonprofit board that is working on advocacy, is working on professional development within the scope of all different groups, not just family childcare education, but center-based educators as well. And so that, to be in a position like that, to be able to support our community, and then to be able to bring people in to say, hey, you're able to also sit at this table, you're able to contribute your knowledge of experience. And so just from my own experience, a lot of family child care educators don't see themselves as these leaders. And so, just sort of magnifying that they have a voice and they have so much to tell us and so much to share is incredibly important in whatever.
Yeah. So one of the things when we think, obviously the National Fund is a workforce development organization, and we focus on job quality and career navigation and systems change and all the things. But I remember a time when the child care space sat outside the workforce development space, right? Amy's like, yep, I remember that, right? And so for us at the National Fund, it's a no-brainer, right? It's just like, of course, if you're talking about improving workforce systems, you have to pay attention to child care. You also have to pay attention to housing. You also have to pay attention to transportation. Like, those are all key tenants or tentacles that support workforce, right? And so I think for me, one of the biggest ahas was just understanding the dearth of conversation around why we should be. I mean, you hear the things like early childhood educators, they aren't paid, like all things. We hear the high line, the top lines around this, but we don't really dig into. And we can guess by how folks are treated in this space that they aren't valuing this, which again is mind-boggling. But when you see that there's not a lot of attention being paid, particularly at state levels around these kinds of things, and just the amount of work that goes into educating people on the importance of this, which again feels really weird that you have to spend so much time educating people on the importance of early childhood education, but we do. I'm not sure if, and I don't know if Josh is going to edit this out later. I'm not sure if the people in the funding space who are sorting these kinds of, who are supporting this kind of work, understand that that's a key piece of it. Like, you can't just get to systems change. You've got to build it, right? And so I see, and I say that because I see in the early child care space, there's a lot of coalition work happening. And so I'm curious, there's union work happening as well too, but can you talk a little bit about that? Do you guys have any experience around the coalition space in childcare?
I can start, and then, but I want to kind of go back to something that Stephanie said, that when she doesn't have planning time, mm-hmm. she feels like she's a failure as an educator, and then she's failing the students. And that is kind of such a great description of our field in general. Instead of like directing our attention to the system and whether it's designed or not to help us succeed or not, we personalize it and say, wow, somehow I've done something wrong. We've seen this around funding and financing. Mm-hmm. People have a hard time understanding if childcare is so, our teachers not making the wages, you know? So this education mm-hmm. piece is so critical. COVID was a turning point for the work that we all do.
Yeah.
And at Strategies for Children, we knew so I would say coalitions and community. So we wanted to think about how is our community coming together? So we started kind of a 9:30 call. We started at 9:30. We did it 5 days a week for a half an hour during COVID. Everybody was home. But on that call, everybody was welcome. We had funders. We had legislators. We had the commissioner. We were writing policy for our emergency childcare programs. And people were saying, like, that's not going to work. That might be a good idea in the desk that you're sitting at as you're figuring it out. But let me tell you what I'm experiencing on the ground. I was nervous as an early educator. I'm like, oh, gosh, we are opening it all up to everybody. But what my colleague Marissa coined the phrase of, like, it's unfiltered advocacy. Mm. And it was the most powerful advocacy we have ever been able to do, because instead of trying to have polished talking points and all the statistics, it was like, this is what's happening. We need to fix it. So I think the awareness gap, we were able to close it. Now, I think we have work to do, and Massachusetts has continued. We're the only state in the country to continue this federal relief grant. So we have seen policy progress, but we also want to keep redirecting back. Like, does that make a difference? What's the question on Monday morning? Like, mm-hmm. does it make a difference when you come into your program on Monday or open up your family child care home? Mm-hmm. And so I think building this community, we also have had our advocacy network. We're in our fourth cohort. This is an experience for in both Gloria and Stephanie. Stephanie's a current participant. To have time and space for you as a professional to build a community, come up with a project, explore an idea that you have, and then learn things along the way. And we also have had coalitions in Massachusetts working on these issues for years, and it's critical. I think what COVID taught us, and as we think about moving forward, we definitely, it sounds trite, but we are stronger together, and we may have made it hard for policymakers when we give them 19 different things that they can't understand the connection, and then it's easy for them to do nothing.
Well, I mean, it also, I mean, I think the other thing around COVID, and I bring this up for a reason, is that it's like forced innovation, right? You were forced to innovate in a space because what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And so to me, that is instructive for how we move through difficult times and challenges writ large, right? Like, so when we recognize that the space that we're in and the challenges that face us, the headwinds, it's like, so what does innovation look like in this space? And so I'm curious, what does innovation look like in 2025 in the early child care space? Amy's smiling like I got an answer for that.
No, I want to turn it over to Gloria, and who kind of has carried on her advocacy network project for 3 years, which is incredibly innovative. Take it away, Gloria.
Yeah, so I just want to reflect on what Amy was saying about, you know, I think COVID brought out, even though it was such an awful time, but it brought out so much goodness in terms of like highlighting the importance of our work. in the early childhood field and the importance, how much we are needed, which is another thing that it brought out. But it also brought out, most importantly, the community piece, because it gave us an opportunity to collaborate more often, to, you know, gather and be resources to each other and uplift each other, which was, you know, something that we've always done, but I think it just made it even, it intensified during that time and after, and even continues. So just the word that we used earlier about showing up and taking up space, for me, has always been important as a woman of color to represent, the, you know, people of color. And so I began a BIPOC group through the advocacy network, and just so we can have a group, a collective group where we are sharing information, being able to identify issues that are, you know, that are pertaining to our communities, our families, ourselves, and have that space to collaborate and be a collective. And it has been a success. We've been able to continue it for the past 3 years. Every month we meet, every day we chat, every day we talk, so that we are within ourselves, this network, but also, you know, amplifying others and reaching out to others about all the things that we do and how we support each other as family child care educators of color in the city of Boston and beyond.
So there are a couple of things that you guys said that triggered another thought that I had based on some of the work that we're hearing and what we're seeing and the communities that we're working in. It's like the importance of self-care, right? The things that are built into that you need to actively create space for. And this is true of home care educators, but also in centers as well too, right? Because there's so much energy that you're taking on. There's so much that you're responsible for. Stephanie alluded to a little bit about blaming herself if something that doesn't show up the right way. But let's talk about why self-care, because we're like, oh, everybody, self-care, like that's an overused term or phrase. But again, if you're sick as a provider, then you can't provide great care to the babies, right? So it's not trite or self-indulgent to think about that. It is a critical part of the job, which is so hard for, again, a lot of women to consider, and particularly for women of color to put themselves first or think about how they show up in the space. But talk about the struggle around that and how what you see happening in the space.
It's definitely the work that we do, long hours, many work, you know, many work 10-hour days, then have to take care of their own families. So it can be like, it can be a burnout. It can be a reason why you would want to stop, because it's so long. And, you know, you're also like creating curriculums, you're cleaning your spaces, you are everything. You know, when you are a family child care educator, you're, you know, the cook, you're the janitor, you're all, the, everything. So it can be a cause to burnout. But, you know, going back to the why is why many of us stay in this profession and want to continue, because it is beneficial to ourselves. So the self-care at times doesn't come easily. And so having this community where you're able to say, hey, you know, I know I see you. I know what you're going through, but let's set some boundaries so that you can take care of yourself and you can continue this without the burnout, without getting yourself sick. So I am number one on self-care, taking care of myself first. And so I want to always like encourage that with, you know, people that are in my circles that do the long hours, are doing all of it and doing amazing work. But also, let's take care of each other.
Yeah,
so that we can continue this work.
I always say, you can't pour from an empty cup.
Say it again, girl.
Yeah. And so, I think it's very important for us to take care of each other. And like you mentioned, Gloria, and to also take care of yourself. You are one of the most important people in your life. And if you are not healthy, if you don't feel okay, then those children cannot learn from you. They read into your energy. They read into what your facial expressions, into what you're feeling. And so it's definitely so important. And going back to your comment about being BIPOC and giving yourself self-care, it can be hard. I'm a daughter of immigrants, and it can be really hard to think that you deserve to have self-care. Like I was always hearing to work hard and work hard and don't stop and keep going. But sometimes you do need to give yourself a break. And I think now we have a different mentality towards self-care and mental health, that now it's a little bit more acceptant to be able to take a day or maybe a few personal hours, come in late, to be able to feel refreshed and be able to support these children. And, you know, I sometimes see the families also give me like a thumbs up that, yeah, you had a home day, you know, and that's good. Take care of your body so that way I know you feel healthy to take care of my child.
Yeah. So I remember looking at some of the early work that our Akron folks were doing, and I was reviewing some of the activities, and they were calling out like, oh, we bought extra plates for people to take food home. And looking at that initially, I was just like, huh, that's an interesting activity. But when you realize early educators have not had a meal all day because they've been running around like crazy, and now you've asked them to show up at this meeting to give, it makes complete sense, right? And so like how that gets translated, right, as a key activity and not a frivolous thing becomes important. And I think that's the narrative change. Like that's where we are in the space. And because that does not happen in corporate America or in other spaces where you have a lunch hour or you have this, right, and you have this dedicated time, it seems weird to see that show up. Like, what do you mean you're giving plates for people to take food home? Like, what is that about? Well, it's about it's about teaching people, like caring for people and creating space for them to see, like, oh yeah, you should, you know, how do you incorporate self-care into your world. One of the things I want to do, I want to hear from each of you a story, if you have one, about one of your first experiences with an early educator as a child. What was, do you have a memory of that?
I guess I could start a little bit. I clearly remember my first day of pre-K. My parents put me on a bus and they said, bathroom means that you gotta go to bathroom, say bathroom to your teacher so that way she knows. I did not know any English, and so it was very intimidating and it was very scary. And I remember still feeling that feeling of walking into my classroom and standing in a big hallway and all these kids speaking another language around me. And it's more so not really about my teacher. My teacher was very supportive. It was about the children next to me. There was one child that spoke both English and Spanish. And at 4 years old, she had to translate everything for me. The teacher put her next to me and had her play with me and group me together with her. And that memory, I always comes back to me when I have a child who's a dual language learner, because I think about that moment. But then I also think about how my teacher just kind of left her to take, you know, to be the one to take care of me. And so now as an educator, I'm like, wow, how can I foster those types of relationships where you have another child supporting another child because of the language? And that translates to a lot of different things too. You know, some of these children come from other countries to our program, and this is their first time in a school in America. So just keeping that in mind, and I always think about that when I have a new classroom every year. I think about that little story.
Gloria, did you and Amy have a story?
Yeah. So I did not go to preschool or kindergarten, but I started school as a first grader, and so I many moons ago.
I know, I was like, Stephanie's closer to an early ed experience.
Her memory's like right around the corner. You know, it was at that time we had bilingual education, so I did not speak English. So, but it was because we had the bilingual education, it felt familiar. And I just remember the warmth, the sort of the connection with the teacher, the art, you know, it was just like, just a good place to be and feeling welcomed. And you know, it's just like how I am as an educator, you know, my babies, it's like loving, welcoming and just, yeah. So that first grade experience was just amazing.
What about for you, Amy?
It's so funny. I did go to a nursery school, which I don't remember, but it was like 2 days a week. My mom was at home. She was not working. I often think of that generation of women who she was very into Maria Montessori. She was way ahead of her time. And it was interesting now kind of where I ended up to see what she was interested in. She always believed that children were competent and capable. And, you know, in all of her life's work really kind of impacted the way I think about it. I will say we moved when I was in kindergarten. And so I went to a new school and I do remember the teacher helping to make me the transition. I had to take a bus, you know, it was all of the things. So I do think it's important to remember, and I, you know, we all work with so many families, but even asking parents who are now bringing their own children, like to ask them that same question. I've learned so much because it does impact how you think about it. I've also talked to superintendents who don't think about early ed as a superintendent. They think about it as like a mom or a dad.
Well, yeah, for sure.
What about as a superintendent? They're like, oh,
yeah.
And I think that's pretty typical, right? But this experience is very personal. When you think about how parents are choosing where to put their 6-week-old baby or their toddler, mm-hmm. And the people that they're meeting, and you know, we know that parents trust pediatricians and their early ed provider, but so how do we reflect that back out to kind of show how important this work is?
For sure, it's funny because I'm prepping for this conversation today, a friend of mine that I've known since nursery school, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, but it was called nursery school then, way back when, 3 days a week. And she sent a picture of our class picture. And to Stephanie's point about representation, I grew up in Asheville, North Carolina, which is not a large African-American population there. But I remember that picture, both of my teachers looked like me, and it just brought back warm fuzzies. Like, these were my early memories, and I remember going into the class, and I remember like the care that they showed, and the love that they showed, and how it felt familiar and warm and comfortable and nurturing and all of those kinds of things. And so I just think it's so I hold on to that. And so when you think about how you show up, how you want to show up and what you want to happen in this space, right? Like, yeah, pulling on that is really important. And so all fantastic stories. As I said to you, I love collecting stories and telling stories. So thank you for sharing yours. We are at the end of our time today. I am so grateful that you all took the time out to speak with us because I know you have lots to do. And you chose to be here with us. And so we greatly appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. State of a Workforce is a production of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. This episode was produced by Josh Enoch. The music in this episode is produced by Alex Productions. You can find past episodes of State of Our Workforce on our website at www.nationalfund.org. To stay updated on State of Our Workforce and all things workforce development, be sure to follow the National Fund for Workforce Solutions on LinkedIn. Don't forget to subscribe to our State of Our Workforce wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. We appreciate you tuning in and look forward to bringing you more valuable conversations in the future. Remember, everybody, life is tricky, so stay in your magic.